you're talking so sweet, well, you needn't. You say you won't cheat, well, you needn't. You're tapping your feet, well, you needn't. It's over now.
And good afternoon, Richmond. You are listening to The Defenders Live, and I'm your host, Anna Edwards. And today is Monday. It's the first time I've been able to come back at you and report on Juneteenth. And that was a pretty big weekend. There was a lot going on, and so I was a little grateful for the rest this past weekend. But as a quick reminder, The Defenders Live is brought to you as a production of The Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality. And to learn more, please visit the website. It's defendersfje.org and defendersfje.blogspot.com. I think if you Google The Defenders, that you can find either site that way. The purpose of having both is that on defendersfje.org, we have more of the historical documentation for the group's activities over the last, since 2002 is when The Defenders got started. And then on the Blogspot, it's really more recent activities and trying to keep you up to date in a slightly faster paced way. So don't forget those two sites. In addition, if you would like to give us a call or contact us about this show and any either show ideas or comments that you may have, the email address is defendersfje@hotmail.com. And there is also a Facebook page for Defenders Live, which is a great place for you to like the program and send me your comments in a maybe a little more direct way even than the general Defenders email. But our telephone number is also 804-644-5834. So those are the methods. I have to say, I'm so, I don't even want to call it behind the curve. I'm just late in terms of Facebook and some of the other effective social networking methodologies for reaching you or allowing you to reach me. And that's probably a little more relevant. So please try to take advantage of that, of the Defenders Live presence on Facebook. And maybe I'll get my Twitter act together too. We'll check it and see. I was forced to get a new phone a couple weeks ago, and so I'm adjusting to that too. I like my phones to last 3 to 5 years, so you know I've got a few apps to catch up on. But it is, I have to admit, it's nice to be able to text with two thumbs instead of just one, and we'll see how those communications flow. Today's show is really, I want to give you sort of a playback on that day, that Saturday, June 18th, which was sort of the focal point of Juneteenth commemorations. It was also considered a Family Heritage Day, as sponsored by the City of Richmond, and the organizations that I have been affiliated with, like the Virginia Friends of Mali and the Black History Museum and Cultural Center, were all deeply involved. And I'm hoping someone can talk to me about what happened this past weekend, which was the Culture Expo, because I didn't get to that. And by all appearances, that was a really well received event that took place at the Science Museum that connected people to what goes on there, but also what goes on throughout the city in terms of our cultural offerings. And I saw the names of organizations and active people that I don't normally see collected in one place. So that was very inspiring. Juneteenth this year had the added compelling component that it's the first Juneteenth that had the torch lit walk along the trail of enslaved Africans that culminated at the burial ground at Richmond's African Burial Ground that was at least in terms of property reclaimed this year. Thanks to the long-term effort, obviously, of activists, certainly our organization, all of those whose work we built upon, as well as all of those who contributed along the way, including those engaged in the legislative process and the city process for procurement and the state. We have reached a very, very interesting moment in the struggle to reclaim this African burial ground. The torchlit night walk ended at the entrance to the burial ground on the Lumpkins Jail site side. And if you were there, it really was a very moving moment. We have all been involved in one way or another, making our sentiments known. And I think that's one of the things that's been so important about it, is that to have this place, and this is why we have these places of memory and history, is because in order to stand there and to be able to put your hands or your feet or rest your eyes on the place that carries such important historical knowledge, such important emotional resonance regarding our history, becomes a key piece of knitting together a community. At least that's what it should do. We have talked in some very sort of straightforward terms that, you know, there's an awful lot to the Confederacy here in terms of monuments, in terms of memorial, not just objects, but places that have been acknowledged and places that are commemorated. The most well-known symbol representing the city of Richmond is a silhouette of the statue of Robert E. Lee. We have innumerable organizations and streets that are named in one way or after another after Confederate figures. And it's you can see in that regard, you know, if we sort of flip it a little bit, you can see how effective that assertion, that reassertion of the importance of the Confederacy to a certain group of people, how effective that has been, that Richmond is, you know, is now and will forever be recognized as the capital of the Confederacy. And the more reading I do by various historians, the more you can get a sense of what it was like to live here. And if you were going to, you know, sit and if, especially obviously if you were a white resident of the area, and this history was yours, and you were trying to determine which side you were going to fight on, and you were just as caught up in the complicated politics of the day and your personal self-interests, the decision that you made to support which side was probably, on the one hand, a lot clearer when it came down to it, but on the other hand, obviously, in historical perspective, it was the losing position. So what happens after you lose the war? After you lose the war, you are trying to reassert a sense of pride in who you are, in some aspect of it. And there are probably other examples of cities like this, but Richmond is a particular example of how a specific aspect of the community came together in a profound way to reassert its identity as as the Confederacy, as a white society. And that has laid the groundwork for some of the most compelling challenges, at least in terms of race relations, in the 20th and now 21st centuries in this area. And it is terribly complicated because the things that get institutionalized, the things that pull enough people together to create monuments or street names or institutions, those things are also smack in the middle of people's daily lives. And so maybe those people who weren't so invested in these particular identity reassertions have had to live their lives surrounded by you know, these markers. And I often think about that because, and I am talking across the board now, I'm talking about both whites and blacks, because not everyone who was white was pro-Confederacy or pro-slavery. But, and living the daily life in a place like this means that you have to do a lot of maneuvering, a lot of psychological maneuvering in order to coexist in a place where some of these distinctions are formally going to be drawn in very clear terms and informally or individually are going to be drawn in very complicated terms. One of the examples would be that the family of the Lovings, Mildred and Richard Loving of Caroline County, when I think about them, I think about the fact that if you look at their story, they were a white and black family living in Caroline County, which is rural, grew up working side by side and in enough proximity that that you had two people who fell in love and wanted to be married and wanted to have a family and whose own families were not, at least in terms of what I've seen, not necessarily opposed to that. It was the state that was opposed to it, and the state that was looking after the way in which it had determined that its society needed to be formulated, that brought the weight of that down on an individual couple, and a family dynamic, a local dynamic. And of course, we look at that, and you can take that and play it and say, you know, well, see, here's where the state interferes, and so we need to watch out for the oppression of the state. But then you had the federal government, which actually stepped into that situation and made it better for not only Richard and Mildred Loving, but for interracial couples across the country. But then somebody says in a different dynamic, well, now we're really upset because the federal government is just sticking its fingers into our lives no matter which way you turn. You can't do anything without them controlling, you know, what you can do. And so there's this downside to the federal involvement, right? And states, locally, states may be trying to protect and preserve some very good programming, some mechanisms that they have found to be successful, and a state program will come in and sort of wipe out their ability to implement that or cut off funding from a federal level. And so then people will start talking about states' rights and our ability as individual states to respond to our local dynamics. Okay, but then that gets tricky because as soon as you say states' rights, my brain takes me right back to the Civil War and to the reasons that have been put forth as to why the South fought so vehemently for what they called states' rights. So, as you can see just from listening to me, the way in which discussion about these issues that we live with here in Richmond on a daily basis just spiral and web in and amongst and around and on top of and below each other. Every touch point of these discussions is so complex that, you know, we recognize that this period that we are in, this period of reflection that we have entered, called the 150-year anniversary of the Civil War and Emancipation, the sesquicentennial of this period, is bringing a lot of things home for people, is lifting other points up, and the environment for myriad layering of discussions is ripe right now. And I would say it's the moment to take advantage of each and every one of those opportunities. It is a moment in which you should assert those ideas, those sort of lurking questions that you've had about these things. It's a good time to educate yourself because it's in periods like this also that the rhetoric flies the furthest, and that the holes get dug deeper, and that very, very tenuous foundations get built for particular perspectives. And so the only way to address that is by educating yourself. And it's always disheartening to hear an editorial like the one that played just before the show started on Tell Me More today. We were talking about the response of our young black men to education, and that they are not seeing the benefit, the point to an education. And worse, I thought, was when he said that they're not seeing a reason to put forth the effort to be educated. So they're in the classroom and they're just like, you know, well, if it doesn't, you know, roll over me and drop itself into my head and make its point on its own, you know, I got to study. course, you know, I'm sort of pulling that from some of my own experiences. When I was in college, a little bit of with my sons, you know, they're like, you know, well, okay, whatever. They're all bright people. And there's an interesting expectation, and this might be a whole other conversation, about if you're really smart, then school shouldn't be hard. It should just, you know, come to you. You should just get it. And the idea of actually spending time reviewing the material that your teacher went over with you in the classroom is like boring beyond measure. I think that's true. I think there are very dynamic ways in which we can be engaged. But it is that idea that to think that there is no value in learning, no value in putting forth an effort to make yourself smarter, to make yourself better able to handle what this society has to throw at you, because as you can clearly hear, this society has a lot to throw at you. If we were off the air, I'd use a couple of expletives at this point, because it's a lot. It really is a lot. But the answer, of course, is not to shut down. The answer is to find the thing that turns you on, that find the thing that drives you. I'll also go ahead and use another example from Tell Me More. When they were interviewing Frank Smith, who's the executive director of the African American Civil War Museum. Think about that, please, as you live here in Richmond. The African American Civil War Museum. The fact that he referenced, I just lost my thread. I love it when I do that on the air. I've lost my thread. But we were talking about learning, and we were talking about education, and we were talking, about what we now know. But here we go. Okay, so let me regroup and get back to the fact that here we are in this period when you can self-educate, when you can find what makes you passionate about something. And that was my thread. My thread was that this man, Frank Smith, decided to start this museum because he was tired of the lack of awareness of the presence of African-American soldiers in the Civil War. It was just that simple. Well, he had 2 points. You know, one was that, and the other piece was wanting to revitalize an historically black neighborhood that had been the neighborhood back in the day. Just like in Richmond, we have Jackson Ward and 2 Street or 2nd Street. A lot of what is going on, I think there is a lot of motivation that is very similar here in Richmond, is that we are trying to make the history known. Because on an individual basis, you can talk to some people, and that even your 20-year-olds who can talk to you about what happened when they were coming up, and then talk to their parents and talk to them about what happened when they were coming up, and they can remember their grandparents and what was coming. So we have a lot of history, a lot of historical knowledge that's embedded in each and every one of us. And we are beginning to have not only institutions, but also just organizations and programming out of churches and just out of people who are moved by a commitment to wanting to make this information known. We have all kinds of ways to get this history out there and known. And I think that one of the things is that we should not be intimidated by the giant formations, because some of them aren't as giant as you might think. There's a great formation called The Future of Richmond's Past. It's one of the first examples that I've seen of a whole slew of cultural institutions working together with a great deal of enthusiasm to sort of coordinate their approach to this sesquicentennial. And it means that each of these institutions is sort of mutually supportive, and they have taken their individual missions and goals and aligned them, at least for this period, in saying each of us can support the exhibitions and the ideas of the other and extrapolate on them. So you will present a story from your perspective and your strengths, and then we can do it from ours. And that way, as people move through the city, they will gain a comprehensive knowledge about the events that are so important to this area. And those things are resonating with people here at home as well as with people who are going to be coming to visit, because an awful lot of people come to Richmond for the history, for the opportunity to put their feet and their hands on the places where these things took place. So that brings me back to Juneteenth. But for a quick moment, I thought I might take a station break and let you know that you are listening to The Defenders Live here on WRIR. It's 97.3 low power FM radio. It's Richmond's independent radio, and it's right here in our community. And I'm delighted that Defenders Live can come to you every Monday here and from 12 to 12:30 and give you our perspective on what's going on in the area, not to mention trying to tie it to things nationally and internationally. And that's why you tune in. And so we appreciate that. So remember that you can find us at defendersfje.org, at defendersfje.blogspot.com, and on Facebook, Defenders Live. Search for it and like it or whatever it says, because frankly, I could use some education on Facebook. The difference between a page and a group and a cause and a... loses me. So find Defenders Live and do whatever it asks you to do in order to be able to follow what we're doing. And let me bring it back and talk to you about that weekend, about June 18th. So the program, of course, was great. Alegba always puts on a great program down there on the Manchester docks. It has the support of the city and the City Slave Trail Commission. And it has... It has the support of a lot of other individuals and people sort of historically have come. And I think the Boy Scouts were there, and they were the ones who were carrying the torches and leading the people along the trail. When we convened at the end of the walk at the burial ground, it was really powerful, because it wasn't just, those people associated, you know, exclusively with the organizing of the event. And it wasn't just, you know, us with the Sacred Ground Historical Reclamation Project and the Defenders. There were, people who represented schools, who represented themselves, who represented the struggle between the Indian and Black communities here in Virginia. And, you know, and that is a struggle that it not only goes back a ways, but in some ways, not in some ways, but very directly goes back to the history of a man named Walter Plecker. And I have mentioned him a couple of times, and there have been a couple of programs that have addressed the issue of Walter Plecker and the beginnings of the Bureau of Vital Statistics here in Richmond, and the adjacency of that evolution along with the rewriting of the Constitution, the Racial Integrity Act of 1924, I think. This is a terribly complicated, mean, and I don't mean that in the schoolyard mean sense of the word, but I mean in a profound, human way, a very mean period in the history of the development of, social mechanisms for governing society. Walter Plecker was a very particular beast, and I do plan to devote a program or two to that history as we build through some other relationships first. And so one of the organizations that was there was the Wayanoke a cappella singers and the Wayanoke group, and that's the Harrells, Anita Harrell and her husband, and he's, forgive me, but they are some very interesting people. Not only can they sing really well, but for a long time they have been working specifically on this issue of racial problems between Black people and Indian people, in spite of the fact that there are a few tribes here in Virginia that by all appearances are now constituted of Black people. And, you know, that goes back to a history that needs to be understood. And it goes to a unity that is still in the offing, is still not quite there, even though we come of peoples who profess to have a history that is built on the idea of humanity as opposed to racial breakdowns. But you cannot discount long-standing histories of individual groups of people and what their interactions have been and the causal factors for strife and conflict. And so this is another component of the history of Virginia that I hope to be bringing to you over the course of the next year. So in that regard, the events at the Black History Museum were also very compelling. They got a beautiful program, exhibit there called Pearls of Wisdom, the Nobility of the Black Family. And there's a small exhibit there on family life as impacted by women in Mali, put on by the Virginia Friends of Mali. That day there was mud cloth making, there was face painting, there were groups who came by from out of state who happened to stop in at the Black History Museum and get a feel for what's here. And that's an institution which, while small, is a tremendous sort of gateway into the family histories here in Richmond and in Virginia. So it was a very, very rich day in that regard. There's a lot going on. There was an international cooking class that morning, which featured Arabic cooking, and which in the coming weeks will feature Jewish cooking and Persian cooking. And if you want to look into the histories of those three peoples, then you will also see there's a lot to understand and has a direct bearing on some of the political and foreign policy issues that we talk about, that we're engaged in today. So I just point all of those things out to let you know that there are low barrier ways to self-educate and to become smarter, more engaged people in the community around you so that you don't have to feel trapped by what you don't know. And I think that's one of the biggest problems and one of those things that causes strife is being trapped by the unknown. So I challenge you. I challenge you to join me next week. I challenge you to go look something up, go read another book, find a magazine article. I don't care if it's on how to build a bicycle or how to blow glass and drink a clean glass of water. But go read something and you'll be amazed by what you can connect it to. I want to thank you for tuning in today, and thank you for tuning in to me and my perspective as a representative of the defenders for freedom, justice, and equality in your community. And again, invite your comments via Facebook. And I look forward to talking to you next week and to hearing from you as we work together to keep up the struggle and move it forward. Thank you for tuning in. And we'll see you next week.
You're talking so sweet, well, you needn't. You say you won't cheat, well, you needn't. You're tapping your feet, well, you needn't. It's over now.